Good morning, it's the Brian Lehrer Show. Brian's out today. I'm Mike Pesca, in for him. And the question around minimum wage is often, how can anyone live on $7.25 an hour? And the answer, as we seem to know, is that it's close to impossible to support a family or even yourself on those wages. So today, instead, we'll talk about who, if anyone, should live on $7.25 an hour. An updated wage calculator shows that the poverty line is far, far below what it needs to be for a family of four to have a, quote, secure yet modest living standard. Joining me now is Elise Gould, economist of the Economic Policy Institute. She's been working on this family budget calculator for the EPI, and it shows how much families from different sizes in different parts of the country need to get by. Hello, Elise. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And so I guess the big headline is you surveyed all these areas of the country and you found what?
We found that it costs more to live than maybe people think. So what we're doing is we're looking at, as you said, we're looking at different communities across the U.S., over 600 different communities. We're looking at six different family types, so from one parent, one kid, up to two parents and three kids. And we're looking at how much it costs to live, not actually how much are people making,
right. But
how much does it actually cost to take care of your basic needs. So we're talking about things like housing, food, childcare, transportation, health care, other necessities like clothing, and how much they have to pay in taxes. So just putting those things together.
So six different family types, 600 places to live. That's 3,600 different variables. And what family in what town can get by on minimum wage?
Yep. Pretty much no one.
No one. The answer is no one. What is the cheapest community you looked at to live in?
What is the cheapest community? There's some rural communities in Mississippi, and not surprisingly, New York City is the most expensive.
But even in Mississippi, and your standard is, I mean, I think we defined it as secure yet modest. So what does that mean?
So secure yet modest, right? That's a really good question. What does that possibly mean in the economic standpoint? When we're thinking about what people need to get by, we're talking about, in terms of housing, we're talking about like the 40th percentile rents in a particular area.
Mm-hmm.
For healthcare, we're saying, okay, we think people should have health insurance. So what does that look like? We're using prices based on the employer insurance market, not the most expensive, not even the middle of the road, you know, even one of the cheaper plans. So those are the kinds of things we're looking at. We're looking at transportation to and from work. We're not looking at transportation to and from the movies.
Right.
So basic things. One of the big things that we're not including is savings. So there's no savings for a rainy day, savings for some sort of a big healthcare crisis, savings for your kids' college, savings
right.
for retirement.
So your definition
None
of secure,
of those
right.
are included.
So secure is minimally secure. Doesn't even include a terrible healthcare catastrophe, but you know, a broken bone won't set you back $80,000. I have the statistics for New York so our audience can relate. You know, you say monthly housing for two parents, two children, let's say it costs $1,474. And taxes, you're going to be paying $781 in taxes. Food, two parents, two children, $754 a month in food. It doesn't seem at all extravagant. It's not going out a lot. It's not wasting food. When you add everything up, your cost of living this secure, modest life in this metropolitan area is $93,000 a year.
Right, for a two-parent, two-kid family, absolutely.
Right, and so the minimum wage doesn't even get you close to that. New York's minimum wage doesn't even get you close to that. And the idea of the poverty line, does that come close to approximating any reality?
No. The poverty line is a measure of absolute deprivation. It's a very different measure of actually what it costs to live. The poverty line, if you're living at the poverty line, you cannot really provide for your family. So when you think about what it actually costs to live in New York City, I mean, also we know that New York City is much more expensive than most other places in the country. And so the poverty line is not adjusted for any type of regional variation in prices.
Right.
And so it's the same poverty line in Mississippi, in Texas, in California as it is in New York.
And what are the practical effects of that? What does the poverty line define?
Well, the poverty line is theoretically what it takes to get by. People think of that it that way. It's definitely a misnomer in that sense.
But I mean, what I'm getting at is
you know, benefits that people are going to get.
Right.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. That certain benefits are tied to either the poverty line or, you know, family living 1.5 times above the poverty line. But, you know, your research seems to demonstrate, not just in New York, but even in, you know, many other areas, twice the poverty line isn't providing you a secure yet modest living standard.
That's exactly right. In pretty much none of the areas are you able to live modestly, live just covering these basic needs month to month. And you can't cover those even at twice the poverty line. That's correct.
The regional differences are what we're talking about. Among the things we're talking about, our number is 212-433-9692. What's been your experience in earning a living wage in different parts of the country? Other areas, what struck you? We all know that New York City is the most expensive and San Francisco is probably second, and counties in Mississippi are much cheaper. But what things struck you as much more expensive when you moved to New York that you didn't expect, and what were the cheaper or still expensive things if you've lived in other parts of the country? 212-433-WNYC. So here in this city and a few other city, fast food workers were striking around the country. They were pushing for $15 an hour pay. What's the thinking behind minimum wage jobs that pay less than a living wage? Is there a defense of those earnings?
Is there a defense of those earnings on the part of business?
Yeah, I know why business would say we want to pay people $7.25 an hour, and sometimes it's justifiable. But societally, what is the bargain we strike when we set that minimum wage at $7.25 an hour?
Well, I think the question we want to be asking is, what would the minimum wage look like if it even kept up with its historical level from the late 1960s? So are we talking about something extreme? If we just went back to the late 1960s, 1968, the minimum wage then was enough to keep a family of three above the poverty line. Now working at a minimum wage of, say, $10 an hour would still be a challenge for anyone with a family, particularly in high-cost areas like New York City. And if we're in a period of high unemployment like we've had, right, everyone's aware we've had for the past 5 years, there just aren't that many options for people to find other work. So if a minimum wage job is all that someone with a family can find under these kind of circumstances, they should be paid at least enough to not be in poverty. And I think it's a choice that we can make as a country where we set the minimum wage. Ideally, we would want more high-paying jobs so workers with families can live with greater security. But we need a backstop, and that's what the minimum wage is. It's a backstop on wages that ensures that anyone who works full-time can afford the basic necessities.
Well, should the businesses be the ones who are providing that? I mean, you know, McDonald's will say a bunch of our employees are teenagers who have all their needs taken care of. They're happy to get the $7.25 an hour, and they're not really providing value much more than, you know, whatever it is, $20 an hour.
Well, when we think about raising the minimum wage, I think there's a lot of stereotypes about who minimum wage workers are. Minimum wage workers are disproportionately women. So if you think about raising the minimum wage, let's say, to $10 an hour, you're going to affect about 56% of those affected would be women. 88% of workers who benefit would be at least 20 years old. These are not teenagers. They're going to be at least 20 years old, those workers who would be affected. And you're going to see that across the board. About 44% of affected workers have at least some college education, right? So these aren't high school dropouts working a job just to get some cash in their pockets. These are people trying to raise a family, working full-time. 70% are in families with incomes of less than $60,000. More than a quarter of minimum wage workers are parents, and over a third are married.
And, there are, you know, 4.7, Pew just came out with a survey that shows that 4.7% of the nation's roughly 75.3 million hourly paid workers and 2.8% of all workers are minimum wage workers. And so even if it's a relatively small number, it doesn't mean, A, first of all, that's significant. Those are millions of people. And it also, I would think that the minimum wage sort of defines a lot of other wages and a lot of business, you know, maybe a reason why people aren't exactly paid the minimum wage is I know in a lot of fast food companies, you know, your first 2 months are on the job or at minimum, and then they start raising you a quarter an hour. And so those people wouldn't be captured in that statistic I just read.
Right.
All right. Let's go to Christopher from Brooklyn on 9. Hello, Christopher.
Hello. what I would like to say is that in 2010, I was working for a Whole Foods market, and I was at the Tribeca location, which is a very affluent location. And the starting wage at Whole Foods is $10 an hour. And at one point, we were soliciting money donations from our customers at the cashier lines for donations for City Harvest, which helps feed the homeless. And I was speaking to a particular customer, and their answer was to me, "The homeless simply don't work for their own livelihood. I won't donate." Mm-hmm. Well, the irony of this was I was working full time, making $10 an hour, and I, in fact, myself was homeless because I couldn't afford a home. And then shortly after that, as typical of Whole Foods, I was terminated just at the six-month period when I became eligible for health insurance. So they don't offer health insurance to their employees in reality because they run this conveyor belt with this open labor market where you work 6 months and then drop just before you get health insurance.
Well, thanks for the call, Christopher. And Whole Foods is usually cited as, even though they aren't a union shop, they don't want unions in there, as paying pretty well. In fact, if anything, it's cited as, you know, one of the examples of the way businesses should be treating their employees. Right, Elise Gould?
Yeah, I think that what this just indicates is that employers are holding all the cards.
Yeah.
Right now, right? In this economy, we have high unemployment. We have many unemployed workers for every job out there across all sectors. We're talking about restaurant workers, retail workers right now. But if we think about just across the country, across sectors, across types of jobs, across industries, across everything, there are so many unemployed workers for every job out there. People are feeling it. This economy, we have seen really no increases in wages over the past few years. And so what has happened is that employers are now holding all the cards.
Yeah.
They have all of the bargaining power. And these workers that are striking, these restaurant workers, are saying enough is enough.
Yeah.
We need to band together and get together and say, okay, look, we need to get some bargaining power here. If we get our workers, we bring ourselves together, maybe we can do something. And businesses, honestly, are not hurting. Profits are at record highs. Those could be shared with workers, and they would be doing much better by their workers, and it would be much better for the economy as a whole. What the problem with our economy is that we don't have enough demand, and people don't have any money to spend. We need to create better consumers out there, right? And so we have to put more money into people's pockets, and that will stimulate the economy. It'd be better for communities. We'll create a more thriving economy in the long run.
And Elise Gould, we have very limited time, but I want to get to one more call because you talked about the backstop and what happens when 725 doesn't get you there. And there are government programs. There's tax credits. But Jennifer from Mohican Lake, I wanted to go to you because you raise a good point about the practical realities of getting some of these government programs. Go ahead.
Well, my point was that I went to University of Chicago and University of Michigan. I taught sociology. I taught anthropology. I had my kids in my 30s. I can't survive on the numbers that they give you in DSS in Westchester. You're not allowed to have a car. You're supposed to take a bus. But from Mohegan Lake, it takes 5 hours to go down to Mount Vernon, which is where they have assigned me to my case. I didn't get my food stamps because I wasn't going to miss work to go to Mount Vernon. The numbers they give you are completely false. It's $25 a month for electric, $85 a month for heat.
And what are the real prices? What does electric cost?
$202 for electric for an 800 square foot bungalow when I use the air conditioning. 800 square feet is all I live in. And they wanted me to put a lien on my home and sell it because they said I had resources. With 800 square feet, there's nowhere else I can go. And there's no housing in Westchester. There's no affordable housing. Everybody knows this.
All right.
There's no affordable housing, no affordable child care, and it's about time our legislators, assemblymen, senators, and congressmen and councilmen stopped joking around with all the other issues and address this head on, because everyone knows it and no one wants to talk about it.
Jennifer, thanks for go ahead, Elise, last word.
Yeah, I mean, I think getting your opinion out there, I think it's absolutely right, and I feel for you. I think there's a lot of pain out there. I was testifying in New York City a few weeks ago on these very issues, and the worker after worker would get up there and talk about how can they possibly survive, and one of the council members turned to the worker and said, well, how are you? They couldn't even conceive of how they were possibly feeding their family, putting a roof over their head, and it's near impossible on these kinds of wages.
Elise Gould, Director of Health Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
In a moment, we'll talk about the summer of flops, box office flops. That's called a pivot. We'll be back in a minute.